Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Wondersuite from Bluehost.com. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and get a unique WordPress website or store right away. From there, you can customize your design, colors, and content. And Bluehost automatically helps you get found in search engines like Google and Bing. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins, Bluehost makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Learn more at Bluehost.com/Wondersuite.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Achtung, Achtung! Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, USA. Before we started just now, it may surprise you as a listener to know that we were talking about Masters of the Air.
I'd really under duress. We hate talking about it. It's such a chore.
The program has led us, I think, directly to what we're talking about today, because I think it's probably something that's maybe in people's minds after the last episode that was aired, which is the Tuskegee Airmen. Have I said that right? Because I've always...
This is always, you know
that thing with words you've only ever seen written down and never heard out
Tuskegee.
Right. Exactly. Anyway, so it's the Tuskegee Airmen. They're the 332nd Fighter Group, 477th Bombardment Group of the United States Army Air Force. But they're not just squadrons.
They start off as the 99th Fighter Squadron. And the Tuskegee name comes from the training base. And the story of them getting up and running and getting into combat is, like all black history in the Second World War, an interesting one, a shameful one. They are a beacon of shining light in overcoming many obstacles and proving many, many people wrong. And one of the key players, I'd say, John, is Benjamin Davis, isn't he?
No question. I mean, so Benjamin Davis, I think, is a fascinating figure. Because he's a son of a general.
The first black general.
Right, the first black general. And so Benjamin Davis Jr. is from West Point class of 1936. And at West Point, he had to deal with the silent treatment because he's black. And there are some pretty prominent members of that class, like William Westmoreland and Creighton Abrams. Don't really think we're part of that, but when you have something that ugly in retrospect, I don't know if you always get the full layers of every grain of truth. So I really don't know. But Benjamin Davis dealt with a lot of nonsense, just to be a soldier, and then thought, really of aviation as his future, and was enthralled, like many guys were at that point, with the idea of flying an aircraft. So he really emerges as like the key leader among the Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's worth kind of, going through the history of it and how they developed and how this came to be and all the rest of it. Because, Eleanor Roosevelt plays a key part in this as well, curiously.
Absolutely, because she basically flies in a training flight, at Tuskegee. I mean, this is the first lady at a time when there's a significant chunk of Americans who feel that a black person couldn't possibly fly an airplane competently, much less safely. And so, I mean, it's horrifying to them, but it also shows just the mindset at the time. So the Army Air Corps, which becomes Army Air Forces, thought of itself as a kind of elite military organization. And they're going to argue, circa 1941, well, we won't take black people. because we're elite. We can't, you know, so black people can't be elite. They can't fly aircraft, all this other nonsense. So this becomes a major political controversy in a football. So it's like a lot of things that are going on in relation to race during World War II for the U.S. You have this duality. You've got the hardcore Jim Crow entrenched racism and abetted by millions of whites who really don't know much about the black experience and hardly ever comes to mind because it's not there for them and they don't have to worry about it. And then you've got civil rights, a major civil rights movement, the NAACP and its allies in Congress that are pushing back against all this. And so the Tuskegee Airmen are kind of the product of a lot of that controversy that's going on in the political arena circa 41 and 42.
Had there been any interwar black flight aircraft pioneers? Because after all, one of the things that you get in the interwar years is this great culture of people who are into flying and who go see people barnstorming and the sort of flying as a spectator sport. And that so, I mean, it's basically every airman's memoirs you read for the Second World War, white airman's memoirs for the Second World War. I fell in love with flying when I was a kid. I saw a plane. I saw people crop spraying. I went to barnstorming events. And then there's a culture around people like pioneers like Lindbergh, and women are flying as well. Mm-hmm. But are there any black aircraft pioneers in the same way?
There are some, but they're working within the heavy strictures of their society. And I think there's a lot of young black kids who are enthralled with flight as white kids. I think that flight in general is more integrated along gender lines than it is along racial lines. But they're on the cusp of the war. There's something like 300 licensed black pilots, something like that. So nowhere near as many as there should have been.
Because although there's Jim Crow, in the North there isn't. And, you know, a young black man is perfectly entitled to join the civilian pilot training scheme program, just like anyone else. What you find with all these guys, I mean, one of the guys I followed was Charlie Dryden, who was one of the originals and wrote a really good memoir about it, mm-hmm. about his time going out to North Africa, flying over Sicily and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, he was a son of British Jamaicans who had emigrated to New York. He was in New York. And what you find is, in the North, there's no barriers to it except the prejudice of the people who are going to let you in. So you've just got all these guys have just got more obstacles to overcome to get to their dream of flying than someone who's white.
Definitely.
And so everyone who gets to Tuskegee and gets on that flying training program and is an officer, a cadet, pretty good IQ. They've all got really obvious skills, already overcome a number of barriers to get to where they are, just to get on that flying training program in the United States Army Air Force by that stage. And their motivations are all absolutely second to none. So they're just a bit keener, a bit sharper than your average white pilot. Now, obviously, you know, that's a broad generalization. The net result of that is that the pilots, when they do get first posted overseas, and again, they're only posted overseas because Eleanor Roosevelt, this is where Eleanor Roosevelt intervenes, because Hap Arnold's just going to put them in kind of sort of, you know, transport duties and sort of backwaters and treat them like other black troops. Once they get over there, they very quickly prove their mettle because they're all absolutely superb pilots, you know, because they've had so many barriers to overcome to get to the position where they're actually sort of sitting on an airfield in Ouija in Tunisia or wherever.
Well, these guys are an elite. And like you said, Jim, they've been sort of handpicked. But the thing that's always interested me about it, and it sort of circles back a little bit to what we talked about in relation to the 93rd Infantry Division in a different episode, in which we talked about their experiences at Bougainville as a brand new infantry unit, that either them or in this case, the Tuskegee Airmen, they're not like just any other pilot, because not only do you have the burden of passing your military training and becoming a proficient pilot and ultimately fighting against the enemy and surviving, you are carrying the weight of an entire race of people in the United States, because everything they do is under the microscope. Everything, for well or ill. And so their opponents, especially in Congress and the Senate, are looking for any opportunity to ground these guys, to sidetrack them, to further their agenda that says, no, black people can't do this. So we are justified in continuing Jim Crow. And that's the way life should be. And on the other side, the pro-civil rights movement, which is gaining great momentum, fortunately, and sort of is invested, though, in saying these guys are supermen. They're doing incredible things, so we need change at home. You know what I mean? So it's really, that's the part that intrigues me the most, for Dryden, for Macon, for Jefferson, Davis, all these other guys who fly these missions. It's not like, you know, the three of us would be as just ordinary white pilots just doing our thing. Think of that burden on your shoulders every time you climb into the aircraft, for gosh sakes. You know, I mean, that's really
And the awful
amazing.
Thing is that they get over there and they get over to North Africa. Then they're posted to Sicily and they do really well over Sicily. And then they're accused of not kind of being as good as the others and not pulling their weight and stuff. And so there's actually some kind of assessment of the performance of the 99th Fighter Squadron in the Mediterranean from their kind of time in Sicily at the start of the Italian campaign, made by the G3 of, I guess, 12th Fighter Command, part of the 12th Air Force. And that downgraded the performance of the 99th Fighter Squadron. So when Benjamin Davis comes back with the 332nd Fighter Group, that's why they're given coastal patrol work rather than proper kind of frontline action. And it's absolutely disgraceful. And the 99th were really good. So there's no reason why they would they've been sort of downgraded at all. And on pretty much the day that it's announced that there is no case whatsoever, his guys shoot down a mass of enemy planes over Anzio.
Proving exactly how right Davis was and how right, you know, all the supporters of the Tuskegee Airmen were. And
yeah,
it's just ridiculous that this ever had to happen. The very fact that the hearings occurred tells you that there's the climate that I just mentioned. So these guys, I think, are especially keyed up. I mean, most of them are very politically conscious, too. They have to be, I think, more so than the 93rd Division guys were on some levels, you know, in part because I think they had to overcome even more obstacles to do what they did, to fly these aircraft and to play this role. And if you really step back and think about it, I mean, these are guys who went through hell in order to risk their lives for our country, for our cause, our allied cause. It's just kind of amazing to think about this barriers that are there for somebody who wants to serve their country honorably in a time of war. And it shows how wrongheaded a lot of the country was, unfortunately.
Yes. And this isn't kind of sort of us being retrospective and going, oh, well, it was different times. I mean, yeah, damn right. It was different times, but there's still no excuse for it. I mean, everyone understood what racism was in the 1940s.
As
we've discussed before, you know, this is what the West is fighting against, this kind of scale of prejudice.
Exactly.
So it's kind of the ultimate kind of paradox, really.
Yeah. I mean, although in the case of the British finds itself fighting, you know, there's been no question that that's why we set out to fight the Nazis. It's the other parallel irony in this, isn't it?
Yeah, no, of course. But
luckily, we found ourselves some proper bad guys on this occasion. You know, this isn't, you know, England or Britain versus France in the old days where there was nothing between them, really. Purely imperial stuff playing itself out in Europe. You know, it is absolutely fascinating, the ironies that abound around this. I mean, if only for a start, that, as you say, John, they've all been selected twice over, as it were, haven't they? They're tested more, they're psychologically profiled, the whole thing, to the point where these crews are the best people, then to be scrutinized and treated as though you're not. And are they given the same sorties and missions as everyone else, or are they given, you know, because one of the things you told us about part of the tension within the forces themselves, you've got some officers who are desperate to prove, you know, these guys can handle anything, and others people who just don't want to try them, aren't interested in giving them proper jobs to do. Is that happening as well, or are they just flying the same?
It is a bit, because the 99th Fighter Squadron comes over and does really well. Then there's this, even despite that, there is then this big question mark over them and whether they're kind of being aggressive enough and all this kind of stuff. The 322nd is formed and you know, back on ops, so to speak. And the 99th is attached to the 322nd, 32nd rather. They're then given 2 months worth of just sort of dud kind of tedious escort stuff where they're not allowed to go see any combat at all. So they're just sort of flying up and down the coast, doing kind of patrols and, you know, recces and stuff like this, and doing absolutely nothing. It's such a waste. And it, you know, poor old Benjamin Davis is just sort of absolutely tearing his hair out at all of this. And it's not until the kind of shortages in Italy and the Mediterranean where it starts to kick in, they suddenly think, oh, well, we better give them a go again. And it's surprising because, you know, this is on the watch of some really, really competent people who you wouldn't expect to be racist. You know, this is, you know, they're in Italy by this stage, and this is Acre and Slessor and General Cannon and and Twining and people like this, you know, who are all kind of progressives. So I find the whole sidetrack, you know, sidelining of the Tuskegee Airmen, it's really, really uncomfortable and disturbing and kind of pointless. And obviously, by the time they do finally get their chance to kind of really prove and show what they're about, they do so with bells on and become, you know, very kind of fondly regarded by the bomber crews who they're escorting, you know, the Red Tails and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it shows too, and this is, I think, especially a lot of African Americans at the time were concerned about. When it came to somebody who was, you know, hardcore Jim Crow, you know, as say an Alabama senator would have been, or Mississippi or something, they knew who they were dealing with there. When it came to someone like Twining or Arnold or whatever, who were not really invested in that world, but didn't want to deal with it, in some ways they feared that more, because the sort of whites who could kind of go either way and didn't care. And I think there was always that kind of pushback of constantly having to put the 332nd and the rest of the Tuskegee Airmen forward, pushing constantly against this institutional sort of momentum that would lead toward backbenching them, because that was the reality of American society. And it was the easier way to go for someone in authority rather than take on the race issue. Usually the excuse was, that's not what we're here to do. We're here to win this war. We're not here to solve our race issue. And, you know, so any normal white commander didn't want that headache or whatever, really, from Eisenhower down too, because remember, he's dealing with race riots in Britain on the run up to D-Day. You know, so I think sometimes that's the larger concern, is knowing who your adversary really is and who they aren't, and you know.
What mess do you drink in if you're a Tuskegee Airman? If you're, our air base is segregated, what's going on? Do they have black air crew? I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, it's all segregated. It's all black units. One thing that's different about the Tuskegee Airmen versus some of the other black combat units, you're not necessarily under white officers in combat, I'm saying. Now, in training, that's a different matter. Back in Tuskegee, and they cycle through several guys, commanding officers, some of whom are very sympathetic, some of whom are not, you know, I mean, whatever. Yeah. Combat, it's primarily, you know, you're existing in a black world in a way. The ground crew, obviously, all of your peers, your commanding officer, you know, Colonel Davis. Yeah, now, what kind of mess would you be able to go to, or bar or whatever? It's probably segregated, though there are exceptions. Once the Red Tails, you know, become famous among the bomber crews and all that, you're going to have plenty of incidents in which bomber crewmen are going to want to drink with the Tuskegee Airmen and are going to go toe-to-toe against segregation policies at times. But you're going to have others, too. You know, I can think of one story. It was a bomber crew that for some reason was at Ramatelli on the base or something, and would not leave their bomber, you know, to go in and have dinner. Insisted on eating in their plane rather than eat in a, you know, alongside black people, and you know, just depended who we're talking about, I guess.
On their missions, are they suffering the same casualty rates? It's just, aside from who they are, their experience is essentially the same as anyone else. That they're losing pilots at the same rate. That men are getting shot down and taken prisoner of war. It's the same picture, right?
Same dynamic.
Flying the same kinds of aircraft or the same kinds of sorties.
Eventually, they get P-51s. They cycle through a number of aircraft. They start with P-40s.
Because I think they go to war with P-40s.
Yeah, they do. They? And then they go to P-47s and then to 39s for a while. Mm. Awful aircraft. And then they get 51s of various models, of course. And we famously remember the P-51Ds with the red tails and all that. That's, of course, a little later in the war. But yeah, you know, I think for the Tuskegee Airmen, in terms of combat, most of their focus really was on escort missions for 15th Air Force bombers. And so here's, again, another classic example where you just don't see this with the regular white units, of this kind of investment in, we have to be perfect. For years, you have this notion that they never lost a bomber in combat. And of course, this just does not stand up to scrutiny. I mean, and it's no shame in it. I mean, fighters lose bombers. I mean, there's flak. You have no control over that. But of course, there's enemy fighters who are going to have a vote in this too. But the point is, the Tuskegee Airmen had a better escort record than pretty much any other unit of which I'm aware. That's what matters, not the idea that they have to be fail-safe and perfect. And, you know, that to me is, again, part of the example of this sort of toxic environment created by racial segregation that then we have to be invested in these arguments, you know, and I think that's the shame of it. So yeah, if you're one of these pilots, mostly what you're doing is you're escorting the bombers and you're sacrificing for them just like any other fighter pilot. But you're probably even more invested in the sense of, you know, you're flying for an entire race. I mean, it's a lot to handle, I think.
Yes, it's a lot to have on your plate, isn't it? It's almost darkly comic, isn't it? The idea that you're fighting the Nazis and you're segregated as well. I mean, if you'd made it up, it would be funny in a peculiar way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. In a sardonic way.
Yeah, yeah. How are they reported? Because back home, because after all, you know, the American military publicity machine is well oiled and picks its stories well and picks its people, and they love a photograph of a heroic pilot back home. So how's that going? Are they sort of sometimes remembered and then hushed up, and then, you know, what's going on?
It's just like the rest of American society, the coverage is segregated. And so the typical African-American citizen would have thought of, like, you know, the main media organs that we all know, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, Life magazine, you know, Newsweek, whatever. They would have thought of that as, quote, the white press. They would have thought of Ernie Pyle as a white correspondent. I mean, so you had an entire black press, you know, famously the Pittsburgh Courier, but Chicago Defender. There's tons of these papers, you know, and magazines like Ebony and whatnot.
Are only read by black Americans rather than white Americans?
Generally, just read by black Americans. And so that's where the coverage generally is, except if we're talking about a political hearing that touches upon, you know, what is happening with these flyers, you know, because of the hearings in Washington or something.
So if you're
an average white person, that's probably the only time that you're going to have any cognizance of who these guys are and what they're doing. If you're African American, they're probably front and center for you because there's constant reporting about them. And that's my point that I made in relation to the 93rd Division too, that the correspondents, there's peer pressure on them to kind of gloss over anything that goes wrong and to make these guys look like supermen because of all that pressure, that civil rights pressure of, well, if anything goes wrong, then the Jim Crow folks are going to come back and they're going to make us pay for it. And we can't have that, you know. So sometimes there's disingenuousness there. And that's actually where the whole idea of the fact that they never lost a bomber in combat comes from. A news story, I think, in March 1945 in the Detroit paper. I don't remember what it was called, but the African-American paper in Detroit. And so then this just gets repeated, as things do in history, as we know full well, sometimes without vetting. And it's only later that scholars have vetted it all and have realized, yes, they lost, you know, a few dozen bombers over the course of their tour, as, you know, fighters will, but they actually had a significantly better record than their white fighter group peers. And I think that's what really matters, I suppose.
How interesting. So the distortions in the racial politics bring into the way it's viewed. I mean, that's very interesting. And when did it become a thing to change? Is that during the civil rights movement that people start to acknowledge, outside of black society, start to acknowledge their existence?
Yeah, and that's really, we're talking probably pretty well in the 1960s and 70s now. And we've talked about this before, that there's a distinct...
Because, I mean, the 99th was disbanded in 1947. The 332nd continued.
It continued, it did. And you know, through the rest of the 1940s and all that. But, of course, then Truman signs Executive Order 9981 in 1948 to desegregate the armed forces. And so, obviously, then the Tuskegee Airmen are going to go away, just as... Once Jackie Robinson begins integration of the major leagues, then the Negro leagues are going to go away. And, you know, so you begin to see and the black newspapers or whatever start to go away. So all that happens over time. But remember, you know, I think we've talked about this in the immediate aftermath of the war. There is a major attempt on the part of I'm just calling them the Jim Crow types as a sort of larger reference to racism and institutionalized racism, to erase the black contributions on a military scale in World War II, and the Tuskegee Airmen be no different. And of course, sometimes this results in violence against African American veterans or servicemen, most famously Isaac Woodard, who is blinded. You may remember, I think we talked about that. beaten by a police officer and blinded. And so really this is playing out as another political issue. And so if you're like an average white kid in the early 1950s, I doubt you would have ever heard that the Tuskegee Airmen would be the probability. Whereas by the 80s, that's a completely different matter, because fortunately society had changed quite a bit, albeit with the layers of mythology that comes about through something good, civil rights change and racial equality, all that. But this idea that they were perfect. No, they weren't perfect. And I think that does a disservice to them, too. It makes them, you know, less than human on some levels.
Well, they're only human, after all.
That's
the point. It's so fascinating. I mean, it's that thing of racism being such bad petrol or gasoline for, if you put it in an engine and you only get bad results out of it, don't you? That's the thing.
It's
in
so
every
toxic.
Single direction.
It's a toxicity created by these decades, if not hundreds of years of racism that had built up in American life and was being challenged, fortunately, and had been many times, of course. We're constantly struggling with this, famously, from the Civil War forward. But this is the other point I would make, that, by the 1940s, if you thought that Black people wouldn't fight, you knew nothing about U.S. military history, literally nothing. You were glossing over the truth of what had happened with African-Americans fighting very well and very hard at various conflicts, most notably, of course, the Civil War, but the Spanish-American War, World War One. I mean, you name it. So all of this is a calculated, conscious thing on the part of those who are invested in the idea of a segregated society. And that's really the thing that's kind of troubling looking back on it now. Like you said, Al, this irony we have of fighting the Nazis. and unfortunately, we in the Western world have some of the same ideas. So that's what we have to kind of confront, I think, to look at ourselves in the mirror. And that's what the Tuskegee Airmen maybe force us to do on some levels, I suppose.
We've got to go to a break.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So.
Brainstorm got too big? Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Welcome back. Were there any aces?
Well, the trouble is, it's very difficult in the kind of last year of the war to kind of actually. I think there is an ace.
Is there?
Certainly get quite a. They get a decent number of DFCs. They get three unit citations.
Mm-hmm.
One for Monte Cassino. Funny enough, they also cause a big stir when they shoot down three jets in a day right at the end of the war.
Wow.
They shoot down two ME-262s and one Comet. And
amazing.
That does get quite a stir. That's another little moment that kind of puts them on the map again, isn't it? And also there's bomber pilots as well. They're not just fighter pilots. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
But the bomber pilots didn't get into combat, though. I don't think, did they? It was a 477.
I think they did. Yeah, they were a medium. They were in the 12th Air Force, weren't they? They were kind of like a medium bomber group, I think.
I would say that among white bomber pilots or aircrew, certainly by the end of the war, the Red Tails had a very good reputation for the most part, anyone who was fair-minded. And it did change some minds. You know, I mean, that's the more uplifting side of this, that there were white air crew who would have had that kind of, if not virulent racism, that sort of intrinsic patronizing racism. And I do think that the efforts of the 332nd did help change things. So it's one of the reasons, too, why there is an emboldened civil rights movement. It's not just African-Americans who of course, are the driving force, obviously. But whites, too, white veterans who are determined to see change as well. And an example I'd give you is, you know, they talk about ironies. Some of these 332nd guys were shot down and became POWs. And the first experience of desegregation they have is in a Nazi, you know, POW camp. I mean, and among some of the white pilots, too. And I think, you know, for some of them, that is kind of an eye opener and leads to some being involved in civil rights after the war. So on the better side of the scale, I suppose.
One way to be confronted with things, and that certainly counts. There's the Freeman Field Mutiny as part of this story, though, as well, isn't it? The attempt by members of men in the 477th to use an all-white officers club, which I stumbled across when I was mugging up for this today, which is an extraordinary story where and it's in Indiana where they're training, and the men try and go into try and use the white officers' mess, and it all kicks off, which is quite an extraordinary story. 101 men arrested, and eventually they're released, and it sort of has to be kind of glossed over. And then, of course, like you say, John, you've got Executive Order 9981 that comes, means everything has to be integrated anyway. I mean it's fascinating, isn't it, that in a way you're that close to integration, just that close, but it's these events that have got you there. So the chicken and the egg is the chicken laying the egg is the Second World War in this instance. I think it's fair to say.
It definitely is. Yeah. Well, and the Freeman situation is so similar to what's happening all over the globe. You have incidents of larger or smaller, you know, impact or scale of all these incidents of people wanting to, you know, crash into whites only clubs of some sort or another and leading to violence. And I mean, it's just an absolute mess. In the situation in Indiana, I think it's fascinating. This is a state that obviously was it's in the North and fought on the Union side in the Civil War. And yet in the 1920s, the Indiana had the largest Ku Klux Klan membership per capita of any state in the United States. So it tells you a little something about the culture in some parts of Indiana. Now, if we're in the heart of Indianapolis, okay, maybe not. But in a lot of small and mid-sized Indiana towns, like where Freeman would have been, I mean, this is the situation. And so sometimes I think it, maybe not in an accepting way, but in a kind of probing way, you have to kind of step back and look at the mindset at that time, that there would have been a lot of people, a lot of white people in that bar who would have told you, I have no prejudices, I'm not against black people, and I just think the races should be separate, that's the way God wanted, and the society has worked well, and I wish them the best, but this is our club. And there were black people who thought the same thing. That's sort of the momentum of the situation until World War II really begins to change that. And many African-Americans had really begun to understand segregation is demeaning and it is humiliating and it does consign us to second-class citizenship. Yeah. And so that's why many are determined to push back against it. But equally, too, it's why so many others felt that this was such a kind of existential threat that it was going to lead to terrible racial turmoil. To stirring up trouble between black and white people that otherwise would not have happened.
Yes, that if you put people together, it's only going to create friction, and which takes you back to Eisenhower. We got a war to win. We can't get caught up in the weeds of this stuff. I mean, also the other thing is on an air base, you've got people from all over the country brought together. So there's no way of reading the temperatures to what everyone's racial politics are going to be and how they're going to fit together. All white people from all over the country, and inevitably not all black people regard this as the same. Some of them might think that they don't want anything to do. They don't want anything to do with white people.
There's some who didn't.
You know,
from a fear standpoint, from a custom standpoint, but also there are some who are radical by now. Probably I'm estimating probably a 10-20% number, usually from northern cities like Detroit and New York, where You have the beginnings of what becomes the Nation of Islam, you know, and are saying, no, we don't want anything to do with white people. White people are devils, and we don't really want to fight for this country either. Now, that's a minority view among African-Americans, but that's there, the Garveyites and all that. Now, the Tuskegee Airmen couldn't be further away from that. You know, among the black population of anybody. But those are the varying grades of opinion. There's also tension between whites, between North and South, a lot of times, too. And so you might have, as a white person, if you came from the North, developed that identity of saying, well, I'm much more progressive on these ideas than white Southerners, than these rebels. And vice versa. there's so many complexities to this that... that I think are fascinating in retrospect, but also a bit troubling, I guess.
Yeah. Do the squadrons still exist in some form? The numbers are they?
I think the 332nd does. Yeah,
right.
And is as of about 10 years ago, I believe.
Right,
and of course, is heavily, of course, decorated and lettered and known. I mean, you couldn't possibly get through any semblance of Air Force history by this time without knowing about the Tuskegee Airmen, and I think such a great thing. It's a wonderful thing. So important.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely.
What did you think of the portrayal of them in... Here we go. I've circled all the way around the airfield back to the Masters of the Air. What do you think of the portrayal of them? What did you think make of that in the most recent episode?
I think it's pretty well done. I was pleased to see two guys who I just find fascinating, Jefferson and Macon. Both of whom, of course, become POWs. And I just think they're two of the more interesting guys on that scale because of their interactions with whites, because of their background, because of the combat they've seen and the struggles they go through. Remarkably similar to their white comrades, and yet it can't quite be, you know? And I thought it was a respectful portrayal. I thought they portrayed their eagerness, the energy pilots generally had. I thought that was really, really well done. I would have liked to see a little more prominence of Davis.
I'd like to see a series on this, you know, a band of brothers on the Tuskegee Airmen, because the Red Tails movie just doesn't work on any level.
It doesn't.
It's just awful. And the CGI wasn't good enough at the time they were filming it, and things have moved on. But the story of charting the whole trial, you know, because it's such a good narrative arc. You know, they start off, they have, you know, all the pilots, so you could follow a handful from sort of Charlie Dryden to Benjamin Davis to the guys you just talked about. There's a whole host of them that you could follow, and you could follow their struggles from segregation, from racism, from barriers put in their way, all the way to they're getting accepted into the Air Force, down to Tuskegee, the kind of the frustrations, the kind of, you know, two steps forward, kind of one and a half back at every single term, just because of prejudice, because of difficulties. The fact that they're actually having to train in Alabama, where Jim Crow exists, you know, it's a horror story. You know, getting over to North Africa, flying in Sicily and over Pantelleria. Pantelleria is the first kind of combat action that they kind of that they see in the beginning of June 1943, and charting that progress from this very, very small kind of early band of just the kind of the 99th Pursuit Squadron to this development into a fighter group, the Red Tails, the fame, the kind of building up their credentials, then the kind of the growing fame, followed by the kind of triumphs, the kind of the rumors that all the bomber pilots want to be with these guys because they're the safest, which absolutely happened. Right down to the kind of three jets in one day. I mean, just imagine the air-to-air combat you could do with CGI now. With that, I mean, it would just be incredible. And it's such a great story. I mean, I can't understand why you wouldn't do that.
I mean, I think we ought to do it. Let's get the right ears. And well, you know, I would take it further. In fact, to me, a big part of a series I would do would be post-war, too, because in some ways, their fight is just beginning when the war ends. Hence the double V, you know, V was for victory, double V campaign for African-Americans in World War II, that, yes, you have to defeat the Axis overseas, but you also have to defeat Jim Crow segregation, racism at home. And that's where the challenge begins for a lot of these guys, because some, when they come back home, they're treated like crap. You know, they're put back into this kind of, you know, whites only world. And you have, of course, a number who are just going to have incredible military careers, like Davis, like Chappie James, who retires as a 4-star general. You know, you have these incredibly successful people, too, in the private sector. And obviously they're consequential and impactful in terms of their efforts for civil rights. And of course, I'm sure there's plenty of disagreements among them, too. And because they're dealing, remember all the turmoil we've got, especially in the 60s and you know, the divide you'd have between militant civil rights and Dr. King and his nonviolent movement and all of that. I think it'd be really fascinating on that side of the equation too.
The British are dealing with not quite the same, but with the Indian Army, there's the how are you motivating people? What are you motivating them for? And that sort of idea that Indian soldiers are, you know, lots are joining up for all sorts of old-fashioned reasons, but a lot are saying, okay, we'll deal with this, the Japanese now, and then we're going to say goodbye to you. There's a sort of parallel there, isn't there, I guess?
It's like questions of citizenship. So yeah, the question for the British is citizenship in what country, right? Your own Indian independent country? Or the French, you know, citizenship for Tunisia, for Morocco, Algeria, for the Americans, are these going to be full equal citizens within the United States? Yeah. Or are you going to continue to treat them as basically less than human beings, as second-class citizens?
And also, what can the state ask of a citizen? And in this instance, it's asking citizens for their lives, and yet it won't let them live full lives within its polity. So that's like that's an enormous question, isn't it? When you frame it like that, it's huge. If people are coming to this new, what should they read, John? Who's written the good stuff about this?
Charlie Dryden's book that Jim mentioned, I think, is phenomenal.
I think it's called A-Frame, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's really well done.
And also Benjamin Davis's autobiography is good. You can still get that.
What's the title of that? It's a really good title.
It is called Benjamin O. Davis Jr., American.
American.
An autobiography.
Fantastic.
Love that.
This has been a fascinating chat. I mean, it is peculiar, isn't it, that a squadron can end up so significant and important. But again, this is the, as we said earlier, when you put race into things, it changes everything. It amplifies, it distorts, it exaggerates and all those sort of things. And I mean, I suppose if you're a Jim Crow adherent, the fact that they're so famous now must really boil you.
I
you know what I mean?
I'm sad to say there probably still are some people that kind of mindset, and it probably does boil them. I think so.
Oh well.
Yeah, and it's you have units in World War II whose importance relative to their size is remarkable. You know, the 332nd, the 761st Tank Battalion, the 92nd Infantry Division, the Montford Point Marines. I mean, whatever it would be. I mean, that's why we look back at this, I think, and I think those of us who study World War II understand how important this is, not just for the war and its outcome, but for the longer term.
Well, fascinating. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for taking us through that. Because I'll admit, it's not a thing I knew anything about, really, until today. Looking it up and looking into it. So thanks very much. Thanks again.
It's
always great to talk. Yeah, it is fascinating, definitely. Isn't it? Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you again very soon. Jim's off to write a book about the Tuskegee Airmen, I think.
And it'll be done by next week.
Can you just imagine the kind of trouble I get in as a kind of sort of white English guy writing the narrative story of the Tuskegee Airmen? I think I might get in trouble, don't you?
Bring a little more objectivity. Well, maybe, but maybe you bring some objectivity. I don't know.
Right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you all again very soon. Always a pleasure, John. And goodbye.
Cheerio.
See ya.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.